This is our next case. It's A20-1371, Kevin Murkowski et al. Versus Children's Minnesota et al. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondents, and we have three of them, I have spoken to the marshal, and it's my understanding Mr. Davidson will be taking 10 minutes, Ms. Nierengarten will be taking 3 minutes, and Mr. Whitmore will be taking 2 minutes. And then finally, obviously, the appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So I guess first I would ask for respondents, did I correctly sort of give the drill with the minutes and, you know, in what order? So
yes, Your Honor.
Great, thank you. All right, then. Then the only thing I ask is when you begin, if you could please keep in mind that the matter is being recorded orally, not video recorded. And I would just remind everyone who is a guest that, you know, you will be able to access this oral recording, I think, tomorrow, but no one is allowed to do their own tape recording. That is a violation of court rules. So just keep that in mind. I'm sure no one was planning on violating it anyway. All right, then, Ms. Smith, whenever you're ready, if you can just state your name in a loud, clear voice, and we will listen to your argument. Thank you very much.
It's going to just take me one moment. I just, my internet was having a problem, and so I had to move my computer, and it turned off, and so I just have to open up a document.
That's fine. Take your time, Ms. Smith.
I'm very sorry.
That's all right. I once cut out during an oral argument for 20 minutes, and I can't tell you how embarrassing that was for the lawyers and me. I'm not a maven either on this stuff. We can hear and see you.
Okay, I'm very sorry.
It's all right. Just take, whenever you're ready, we'll begin. I'm glad you were able to contact us.
Okay, so first of all, I also want to apologize. I am not an attorney who practices regularly in litigation. I never intended in my career to litigate. In fact, I had let my license lapse because my daughter became ill, and I never I was much more interested in being a disability rights advocate than I was ever in practicing law.
Okay, Ms. Smith, just 1 minute. I would ask the marshal to restart the clock.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought the clock was running. I'm sorry.
Well, right. But, and I don't want to, would the marshal restart? Yes, thank you. Ms. Smith, there's no need to apologize, and I don't want to eat up your time without getting to the merits.
Okay.
So you might want to just go straight into your argument that way. And we're all appreciative of the situation. Okay. And well, why don't you just begin your arguments?
So I brought this case to the court under the bias statute. And I understand that this is a statute that is not used and has not been used very much. And the plain language of this statute, I think that my what I have filed in my both the underlying case and in the appellate documents, I think speaks for itself. And I, because I have never given oral arguments, I don't really know how much I have to reiterate everything that is in the written document, because I think the documents do speak for themselves. I will say that the current events that we are facing in our society have given me a great deal of pause. And I want to be honest about that, because I feel like our law is written far too broadly, and it gives me a lot of concern. And I'm just going to be honest about that, Your Honors, because I believe that the way our law is written, that every person who witnessed the matters before us as a society with George Floyd, every person who watched that video and was present could potentially use our bias statute and could state a claim for emotional harm. And I don't know that the law was intended to be read so broadly. And I'm concerned about that because I think the decisions that you make in my daughter's case could have really serious implications for our city and our state. And I've spoken with my entire family and who are all plaintiffs in this case about that. And we would hope that the court thinks really seriously about the implications because plain language matters. And this statute is written really, really very broadly. Even if there's no criminal case before the court. And so I would hope that the court does actually narrowly tailor its decision in my case, even if it is adverse to me and my family. Because I think the legislature really does need to consider what the bias statute means. That being said, we believe 100% that my daughter was in fact murdered, that there was great offenses done to my daughter, and those offenses were done to protect various people at the children's hospital. We never wanted to pursue litigation. We always wanted just to get to the truth of what happened to her and for the people who committed the offenses to be held accountable. And we never wanted any monetary damages at all. What we wanted was for the system to fix itself. We wanted to be sure that there was no ghetto at the children's hospital. We wanted to know that children with disabilities were treated with respect and that families were given access to information. So when we wanted data, when we wanted information from the hospital, we wanted to get that. We didn't want there to be no surgical report available to us. There should have been surgical reports. When the nurses told us that there was a ghetto, that they called a unit of the hospital a ghetto, that on itself is bias, that shows the bias. So what we want is for the hospital to, we wanted to meet with them from even when she was still alive. We sought to work with them. So the bias in and of itself on its face is in the case. So as to the bias,
Ms. Smith, if you don't mind, I really don't mean to interrupt you because everything you're saying is very important, significant, and you do, it's a very compelling case that you present to us. We unfortunately are here with you today on, you know, your third complaint. It's quite clear that you've tried several times to bring forth your views and have them heard in a court. And despite your apology earlier on for your lack of experience in litigation, you've certainly shown a great persistence in presenting what's happened to you. And we do appreciate that. But I have a few questions. Our time is limited. So I just want to make sure I get a chance to ask them and hear your answer. So one of the things that concerns me in this case, first of all, is to make sure I understand exactly what the legal claim is. And I think you already said it, so I just am confirming it. So this, the only legal theory you're presenting now is a bias offense claim under the statute. So that's, I'll just say that for the record, it's 611A.79. Yep. You're not pursuing a wrongful death action.
Nope.
Right. And you say that in your brief. I just wanted to be really clear. So here's my other, it sounds like we agree on that, but feel free to comment. So here's my other question for you. We don't have a complaint in the record. That was commented on by the district court. And even before this matter was argued, the district court judge asked you to file a copy of the third complaint is the one that I'm talking about, the one in front of us. So can you help me understand, do you think it's in the record or did you, is there a reason you didn't file it with the district court?
So I think that when the defense, I actually did think it was in the record. We had the same judge and I believed actually because it was referenced and brought in to the matter by the other parties. They filed it. We were hoping actually at the beginning that there would be a meeting and a discussion. And I didn't initially file it. The other parties actually did. And because I don't litigate, I thought because that they brought the matter to the court. So I thought that they did have it. And then the judge in his ruling was he talked about how he was familiar with all of the information when we had our hearing. Anyway, so it was a misunderstanding about the underlying issues because we had the same judge too. And so in the discussions, he knew everything about everything. And So yeah, it was.
Well, I guess I was assuming, Ms. Smith, because I know, you know, your second complaint was dismissed. You took an appeal, but then later that appeal got dismissed. So the judge's order, and I understand it's Judge Wall in both cases, that Judge Wall's order on the second complaint is final as to you. You know, that is,
right. Well,
we consider that litigated. So I guess what I'm struggling with is, I don't exactly know what the allegations are in your complaint. And if you've read what Rule 12 case law says, it directs our court to take all of the allegations in your third complaint as true and then decide, do you have a legal claim? And we don't have the allegations. So I'm struggling with how we proceed.
I guess I'm not 100% sure how you proceed, because I'm not an appellate attorney. I don't know, but I would say that the complaint is that the plaintiffs were harmed by observing the actions of what these people did to my daughter. Very serious harm. I mean, I have children who are afraid to go to the doctor in the hospital because of what they watched. And this COVID has made it a disaster, a nightmare. I mean, I have children. So,
if I understand your briefing correctly, you're saying that all of the named plaintiffs are family members, and right, that they visited your daughter while she was in the defendant's care.
Yeah.
And that's the basis for their claim. Is that right?
Right. We were all present. It was actually over 20 months of the care. There were multiple procedures. There was incredible suffering, pain. They were present for many arguments with the doctors when care was not being administered and provided. It was an incredible process in a horrible situation, and the denial of care and the knowledge that treatment could have been provided and wasn't being provided. And the issue of the ghetto was very, very present.
So following up on Ms. Smith, on Judge Bradfield's point. So, you know, I think we all have a copy of the statute in front of me. So it requires a crime. So you're saying the crime is murder. And then, as I understand it from the briefs, the allegations are your daughter died of the bacterial infection, and that was a result of bias, because your daughter was in this, what was referred to as a ghetto section of this hospital. And in turn, the nurses committed murder because they didn't check on her regularly as they do in other portions of the hospital. And as a result of that, she died.
No. So my daughter acquired an infection, and at some point in the hospital when she was there, there was a lab result that came back that said she had something called gamma hemolytic strep. And we knew that actually was, there's no such thing as that, because the name on that bacteria was changed in the 1980s to a different bacteria. And so we know that there is no such thing as gamma hemolytic strep. It's actually an enterococcus. And I raised that issue because it's called VRE and it needs to be treated quickly and promptly. And I raised that issue with the doctors and they told me that I was wrong. I asked for repeated cultures and susceptibilities, and they wouldn't do them. And it took several weeks. And then finally, a new doctor came on to round and she agreed to do them. And by that time it had mutated into two strains. And it turned out I was correct. She had two strains of VRE. Not gamma hemolytic strep. And then they treated her only with a half a dose of the antibiotic, a half of the treatment dose. And it was the failure to treat, the intentional failure to treat. So somebody changed a label in a lab report. Then the doctor, every one of the doctors that rounded on her, we raised this issue and tried to get them to treat her. In the last month of her life, when they refused to treat an infection that could have been treated, because twice before she had acquired the same infection that they did treat. But we believe that she acquired this infection when a nurse miscalibrated an IV pump and my daughter sat up during a procedure, which I observed. And they with all of the records related to this procedure that had been done a year earlier, all of the records were removed except for later on references to it, which they missed. And so we then, in this whole process, she had remained on antibiotics from that point forward. But then this particular infection, when they wouldn't treat it, when she got sick enough, they wouldn't treat it. They wouldn't treat it at the end. And she ended up with multiple. She had 8 bacteria because she just got too sick. They hit it. And then it was the last 2 months of her life. She was bleeding out of every orifice. And then they half treated her. And because of the delay in treating her, it got to the point where she could no longer be treated with it at all. And then she got 8 different bacteria because once they didn't treat it, as you get sicker, your body can't fight things. And it was like dominoes. So here's the point, that we don't know, because we don't have records. We know there were missing records. We know that somebody changed the lab report. But there should never be missing records. But we can't even get discovery. And this is the point. And by the way, I want to talk about the case at the Court of Appeals that we dismissed, and it was very frustrating.
Ms. Smith, I think Judge Jessen has a question for you. I was wondering if you could just okay. Judge Jessen.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Conley. So, Ms. Smith, mm-hmm. you were there, and for the purpose of this question, I'm assuming what you told me is absolutely true.
Right.
But that happened more than 6 years before the complaint was at least served, right? You know, this third complaint. As I understand it, this happened, you know, before November 16th, 2013. And the cause of action for this recovery says it has to be filed within 6 years. Now, I don't know the exact service dates, but I think Children said that it's undisputed that they were served more than 6 years later.
Well,
so why isn't this barred by the statute of limitations?
No, they were served. I believe they were all served properly by the statute of limitations. And I think all the data is.
So if I can say, you know, I noticed Children said that they were served on November 18th, 2019. Is that correct? You know?
Because it was a Monday, or, you know, because of the weekend. Right. Because of the way the dates fall on the weekend.
Well, maybe the respondents can address that as well during their arguments.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I make the arguments in my case. I think I lay them out as all the arguments about service, I think, are laid out. I think my concerns, they raise an issue about one of their doctors who was no longer working. However, he's actually still, as of a month ago, he was still listed as being the contact person, and he's working from home. And I think it's a lot of issues with COVID that are very serious for this court to consider, that when you have your person who's listed on the Secretary of State's website as the contact person for a corporation working from home, I think that it's when you want to continue to actually limit service even more than it's limited now, but people are working from home, I think that is a grave concern because he was working from home. And they're trying to say, actually, he's not even working for them and hasn't been for 5 years, yet he's still the person, even as of a month ago, I believe, still listed as the person who represents the company. How can you be for 5 years still on the Secretary of State's website? It doesn't make any sense. So,
Thank you, Ms. Smith. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll begin with Mr. Davidson, please. And you could just identify yourself and which party you're representing. Mr. Davidson, you're muted.
Apologize. William Davidson on behalf of Respondent Children's Respiratory and Critical Care Specialists. May it please the court. I'll be taking 10 minutes, as we indicated, trying to cover all the issues that are common to all respondents. Ms. Nierengarten will take 3 minutes, and Mr. Whitmore will take 2 minutes on behalf of their respective clients. We believe Judge Walls.
Mr. Davidson, I understand we've got just a short bit of time with you, so I'd like to follow up on Judge Justin's question about the statute of limitations. I realize that you're contesting whether you were effectively served, but let's just for the moment assume that the plaintiff's service on your client was effective. So talk to me about the 6-year statute. So Ms. Smith has argued, and she's got a statute supporting her, that when the 6 years last day of the six-year period ends on a Saturday, which I think is true here, that it would still be timely when served on the Monday following. Could you respond to that?
I can attempt to address it. I believe Mr. Whitmore will also try to address it, Your Honor, because as you noted, we do believe we were not served properly, even on Monday, November 18th of 2019, which was more than 6 years. And the statute is plain, unambiguous language. It's a six-year statute of limitations under the bias offense.
Right. Well, you're familiar, aren't you, with the statute I'm referring to on computation of time? It appears to apply to all of our
statutes. Well, I
can't find a case that says that, interestingly, but I do see that that's the way the statute's written. So
there are no cases that we've been able to find, Your Honor. We've reviewed this and addressed this, even though I don't believe it was properly raised below, and it certainly wasn't addressed in the appellant's merits brief. They've just broadly stated a conclusion that it was, quote unquote, timely without advocating a specific legal argument.
Well, I know the argument was made by Ms. Smith in the district court hearing. And of course, we're bound by the statutes in terms of how we compute time, right? I mean, this court can't just sua sponte decide on a different way to compute time.
Correct. And so, as I read, Your Honor, to the extent the argument is that it's Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 6.01, which is the counting statute.
That's not her argument, counsel. So the statute, if you don't know, is 645.15. And it says exactly what Ms. Smith argues it says. So I am looking to you for argument on that. I mean, if you don't have it, that's understandable because you are contesting effective service. And if you want to argue that, that's fine.
I think, Your Honor, to the extent, and with respect, I'm not quite sure exactly what Ms. Shogren-Smith's, what appellant's arguments are, because I don't think she raised 645.15 below or in her merits appeal brief. I don't think she raised Rule 6.01 to the extent she's relying on 6.01.
So, Mr. Davidson, I don't mean to belabor this point if you'd like to move on to something else, but Ms. Smith clearly has argued that the last day of the six-year statute was a Saturday and that her service on these defendants on a Monday is timely under Minnesota law. She's made the argument. You may be correct that she didn't cite the exact statute, but that's not usually the standard that we've applied. And as I said, the court is in a bit of a bind because, of course, we have to follow Minnesota statutes on how to compute time.
Understood.
Okay? So, and we can move on. I really don't mean to take up your time on this issue. It just seemed to me we could perhaps, narrow down the issues that are in front of the court.
I think, Your Honor, I will move on. I know Mr. Whitmore is prepared to address this more directly. I think you can narrow the issues even before you get to the statute of limitations. And we will note Judge Wall did not address this directly below. In fact, this is an alternative argument we're raising on appeal. And even if we're wrong or if the court reaches the issue that Judge Wall did not decide, you can and should still affirm for a variety of reasons. As to my client, CRCCS, there it is undisputed. They were not properly served on a Monday. They were served by the affidavit of service that was ultimately filed at Stack 39. It was left with a woman who identified herself as his wife, meaning Dr. Stephen Kurachek. And we believe under 4.03 that as improper service on a corporation, the most applicable case out there is the Obermeyer decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court from the 1970s, where a public corporation, in this case the school district, was attempted to be served identically by leaving it with the spouse of a school board member who could have been served on behalf of the public corporation. Appellant has raised no reply brief arguments, and at least as to my client, we believe service was improper and therefore the dismissal was proper. Assuming that my client was properly served, and as to all the respondents, the district court also properly ruled on res judicata that this claim is precluded for a number of reasons. This is the third lawsuit. All of the allegations are the same that arise out of Ms. Shogren-Smith's daughter's death. All the allegations against the three respondents are the same to the extent it's in the record. I will note.
Would you mind, counsel? I know all of the lawyers are much more familiar with the record than I am. We have combed it and looked for a copy of the complaint, and we cannot find it. So is that, I mean, that is what the district court said in the district court's opinion. So I just want to make sure that I've covered my bases and asked you.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that, and from my review of the record, it is not in the record. I will note on that point, if you look at appellant's statement of the case, which was filed October 29th of 2020, on page 4, midway through the narrative, appellants recognize the judge, quote, the judge was clear the record and arguments were sufficient for him to make a ruling. And ultimately, as Judge Wall noted in his memorandum, it is the plaintiff's or the appellant's burden under Rule of Civil Procedure 8 to show that they are entitled to relief. And to the extent they failed to show that by specifically identifying the allegations that would be subject to the Rule 12 standard for you to apply, they have failed to meet their burden. But the complaint itself is not in the court file, according to my review, and I think my fellow respondents' counsel's review of the record. What we do know about the allegations in the complaint would be subject to res judicata. They all arise out of the same set of facts. They involve the same three defendants. All three defendants or respondents were defendants in the first lawsuit, the second lawsuit, and now this third lawsuit. The only issue that was addressed below, or really that might be on appeal here, is whether or not the appellants, the plural, the nine family members, were in privity with the one plaintiff, appellant, the trustee in the second lawsuit, who happens to be Ms. Shogren-Smith. The district court, I believe it's at A30 to A32, in terms of his analysis, did a very extensive and detailed analysis of who is in privity. And we believe that was appropriate and that he appropriately found that they were in privity. In the first lawsuit, an attempt to bring suit on behalf of the estate of Ashland Smith. The second lawsuit, the trustee on behalf of the heirs and next of kin of the decedent here. And in this third lawsuit, the nine plaintiffs, appellants, are all family members, adopted or biological, of the decedent. And the case law, we believe, is clear that they are in privity. I'll refer the court once again back to page 4.
So, Mr. Davidson, when the district court made its analysis of privity, it had already decided the bias offense issue. So it had already decided that the third complaint stated a bias offense, if at all, only as to the deceased child, and that the family members didn't have a complaint. So because that's really, as I read it, Ms. Smith's argument now is that the reason res judicata doesn't apply is because the bias offense that is asserted in the third complaint is the personal claim of each of those bystanders or witnesses, family members to the child, you know, who, as we just heard in Ms. Smith's opening remarks, were there and witnessed everything. So I guess I'm trying to figure out if you have a res judicata argument if we agree with Ms. Smith on the bias offense statute.
I think you do. And, you know, certainly Judge Wall, whether he addressed the standing issue first or addressed the res judicata issue first, it doesn't change the result. The appellants, even for their quote unquote personal claim, lack standing because all of their claims arise out of the death and is, at least on the facts of this case, which happens to be a wrongful death case, all claims arising out of the death of a decedent must be brought as a wrongful death claim, which they were in lawsuit number 2. They were brought in this third lawsuit, but that claim has been abandoned on appeal. And then Judge Wall also found in rejecting the standing argument, in rejecting the personal individual bias claim, that only the person damaged by a bias offense can pursue such a claim. And that in this case, the family members observing the matter cannot bring their own personal claim because they have not been damaged. And I'll simply note, as my time expires, this claim, this statutory cause of action, is in derogation of the common law. And as Ms. Shogren-Smith asked this court, we would ask this court, to the extent you even get to analyzing the bias offense statute, that you should construe it narrowly, that you should not broadly construe any person damaged by bias offenses to mean anyone asserting a claim. It has to be the person harmed by the criminal conduct, which, as Judge Wall found in both the second lawsuit and this lawsuit, was not sufficiently stated. And it has to be a crime, in this case, murder, committed because of a bias offense, and that the allegations in the second lawsuit that were in the record and that this court can take judicial notice of were not established. And the allegations in this lawsuit, which are not of the record, simply do not establish that. And this is an imperfect vehicle for this court to analyze the specific needs of the bias offense statute. Without taking my fellow respondents' time, I'm happy to address any issues of the court, but I'm cognizant of their time.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. We'll now hear from Ms. Nierengarten.
Good morning. My name is Julia Nierengarten. I'm here on behalf of my client, the Children's Heart Clinic PA. I believe Mr. Davidson has addressed the argument supporting affirmance well, and I just want to take a couple of minutes to specifically address the service issues as to my client. Appellants have never served the Children's Heart Clinic PA in this action. Instead, they served a different entity's president, and they never tried to correct the service issue after they were made aware of that problem. They argued that they were confused about the correct entity, but the law does not have a confusion exception to the service requirements. They've also argued that the Children's Heart Clinic PA obviously knows they're trying to sue us, and so the improper service doesn't make any difference. But Minnesota law is clear. The service requirements must be strictly complied with, and the court can only acquire jurisdiction when they are. Serving a completely separate entity with a similar name simply is not effective service under Rule 403C. Instead of serving my client, appellant served a corporate entity created by Children's Minnesota through which it bills for services. It's a completely different company with completely different officers and managing agents. We don't have any interest or control in that company. It has a different address, a different filing number with the Secretary of State. And I would direct the court to look at the chart that's contained both at the district court order on page 9 and in my responsive brief on page 12, kind of lays out in a little bit more detail the difference between these two entities. Moreover, appellants argue that they were confused about which entity was which, but this argument makes no sense because it appears that they managed to serve the correct entity, which is the Children's Heart Clinic PA, in the two previous lawsuits. Again, there's no confusion exception to the service requirements under Rule 403C. Serving a completely different entity with a similar name does not constitute effective service on the Children's Heart Clinic PA. And finally, appellants argued that because the Children's Heart Clinic PA knows that they're trying to sue it, their failure to properly serve it does not matter. Our moving to dismiss under 1202C for failure to effectuate proper service does not waive the improper service in this matter. Participation in litigation doesn't waive the jurisdictional defense when the moving party, in this case my client, simultaneously moves to dismiss on the jurisdictional issue and on the merits. The reality is that appellants simply failed to serve the Children's Heart Clinic PA at all in this matter. This utter failure justifies the district court's dismissal of their claims against it, and we respectfully ask this court to affirm the district court's dismissal on that basis. If the panel doesn't have any questions, I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nierengarten. Final, Mr. Whitmore.
May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Mark Whitmore. I'm here on behalf of Children's Hospital. Two issues, both of which have been raised by members of the court. First, I just want to point, on May 11th of 2020, Judge Wall issued an order requiring the plaintiff to file her complaint by a specific date, which she did not do. This is referenced on pages 5 and 6 of his order, which is the subject of the appeal. So I wanted to address that briefly because I know it was raised by a couple of you.
Let me just follow up with you on that question. You're absolutely right. That is the date of the order. And I appreciate you calling it to our attention. So the district court judge, both at the oral argument and then at the hearing, and then again in the written opinion, decided to just accept and as a substitute for the plaintiff's complaint, the arguments that were made in Ms. Smith's brief. And I didn't see an objection by the defendants to that approach. Did I miss it?
I don't believe it was formally objected to, Judge Bratbold. I think you're right. It was an issue that the judge was concerned about. He ultimately made a calculation that this is what I have, and this I have enough familiarity to address it. But I wanted just to make certain that the court was aware of that, because you had raised it, I think, with Mr. Davidson. Mm-hmm. With respect to the issue about the statute of limitations, and it was, as Judge Bradfold, as you mentioned, it was mentioned in oral argument. It was not briefed on appeal. But I really think what we need to look at with respect to 645.15 and Rule 6, those are computation statutes, which are focused on calculating days and counting days and when things are due, as opposed to just taking a fixed date, which is 6 years from the date of the incident, and then that's the date that it runs. And the reason that's a little bit different here than it is in calculations, and is it okay if I finish my, just respond to that question?
Yes, please do, Mr. Whitmore.
Thank you. And this issue hasn't been addressed by the courts. It hasn't in Minnesota. It hasn't been clarified. There's no rule under Rule 3 or 6 or other statute to specifically address when you have a date established by when an event occurs. Does it apply? And I would submit to you that that isn't the right. A computation is a calculation, counting. And that's not what we're doing here. And it makes sense here, because in this situation, I think that rule is really more about counting and getting access to the court system. And we, as the members of the court are aware, just Minnesota, we don't need to.
So, Mr. Whitmore, I understand that you're answering this on the fly. As you said, it was not an issue that was briefed. So I'm not, trying to surprise you by my question, but I just have to ask you, as a lawyer who's practiced for a very long time and is highly respected. So this method of computation of time, the one where if the last day happens on a Saturday, the deadline rolls over to Monday. So this is throughout our legal system, our rules of civil procedure, our rules of criminal procedure, notices of appeal, the time is computed that way. I mean, so for you to present to me today, and like I said, I totally understand it's you're doing this on the fly, to help me put this in perspective. And doesn't it make sense to apply it the same way?
I look at it differently, with all due respect, Judge Bradfold. And part of the reason is that rule, which you correctly address, is focused on access to the courts. This is focused on service. Okay. And this, she doesn't need access to the court to serve the complaint. In fact, she could have delivered the case to delivered the summons and complaint to the sheriff, which under Rule 3 gives them 60 days to effectuate it. And that's why I really think it's a little bit different.
You're assuming that some of the other deadlines aren't based on service. So for instance, a notice of appeal isn't effective until it's served, right? So actually, I'm not sure. Again, I know you're arguing on the fly, so I'm not trying to stump you, but I think this is a harder issue than your argument is suggesting. And maybe it's a reason for this court not to decide it or to, in light of the lack of briefing. And so if that's, you may agree with me on that, you may not. But I just want to present to you that this is a hard issue.
I completely appreciate that. And I think whether the court chooses to address this Saturday service issue, the case really rises and falls beyond that on the res judicata issues, which Mr. Davidson's addressed, that's a fully briefed, the standing issues, and whether this cause of action for anybody who witnesses an alleged bias is even a viable claim. So, yes, a little bit blindsided. I did my best to address it. I appreciate your questions. Unless anybody has anything else, I've exceeded my time already.
Thank you, Mr. Whitmore. Ms. Smith, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You have to unmute, Ms. Smith.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for your patience in this process. I just want to respond to a couple of comments that were made by the other counsel and then summarize, conclude. First of all, I think that this whole process has drawn attention for me to a lot of problems within the system. As to the service, I think this issue raised by the Children's Heart Clinic is a really serious issue, and I hope the legislature does revisit these issues. The issue of playing games with names is really a serious problem, and I do think that it's a bit of gamesmanship. And it's in my brief, and you can see it, as are the issue with addresses. The Children's Heart Clinic is located actually on the Children's Hospital campus. So the idea that the addresses are different, all of the addresses are on the campus of the Children's Minnesota Hospital. That's where it's located. And the difference of the word the Children's Heart Clinic or Children's Heart Clinic, these are all done for billing purposes. And for lay people, they can't tell the difference. And families will say repeatedly all the time, nobody can tell who anybody is. I get it that the lawyers might know, and maybe I should know, maybe I shouldn't. But this is a broader issue, and the Secretary of State and the legislature should, I think, make it clear. It's important that these entities all be delineated in a much more clear basis, doing business as for billing purposes. There are lots of ways this could be fixed, just simply even adding on a billing entity or something. I don't know. But the bottom line is that a lot of changes happened, and the websites changed, saying that they were now partners in a different way and things like that. So the court will obviously do what it's going to do, but I just want to make it clear that there were changes during this time period as to how they appeared to be doing business with their relationships contractually. Back to the Children's Respiratory Critical Care and Dr. Kurachek and his wife in receiving service. When Dr. Kurachek is doing business at home, working from home, I don't think it's an appropriate relationship to say that we can compare Dr. Kurachek to a school board. That is, it's an invalid leap. And I think that when he begins working from home, then the service rules are should be much more similar to a person working from home in a home office than a school board member who can be served at the school board, which is a public entity. The hospital, the Children's Respiratory Critical Care, is not the school board. It's not a government entity. So I think that is wrong. I think Mr. Davidson, I believe his name, I think he sort of made my case. This issue of personal harm in a bias case, I don't think that the legislature intended to exclude family members from being able to be impacted by a bias case. I think that, in fact, often family members would absolutely experience personal harm from a biased case, from a biased.
I want to ask you one final question, because I think, you know, it's an interesting issue you're raising as to, you know, the individuals who can be harmed, and that sort of relates to the res judicata. But I guess one question I had is, and since we don't have the complaint, you know, in listening to your recitation of what the hospital did, you know, one thing the bias statute requires is a crime. And the allegations or the statements you were making in terms of, you know, the lab results and the delay in treatment, I mean, I will get right to the point. That sounds like negligence. That doesn't sound like, you know, intentional murder. So what I'm trying to understand is, you know, and since we don't have the complaint, what is your allegations? I mean, is it your allegations the nurses, the doctors all did this intentionally?
Yes.
To kill your daughter?
Yes, the doctors in particular. And I can equate it exactly to the George Floyd case. I can, because it brought it all home, that the trauma that my family has been living with and listening to them talk about George Floyd not being able to breathe. He didn't breathe for 8 minutes. My daughter struggled to breathe for 20 months while she was hospitalized with one injury to another in the last 2 months of her life. And we watched her fight to live. We watched her bleeding out of every orifice while they denied her care. And we had to fight and demand and beg and plead for them to treat injuries that could be treated. We had to beg them to give her medications. We begged for 20 months. We, as her family members, were begging and pleading for them to treat her, begging. I tell you, begging those doctors to give her the treatments that we knew she could get, begging for them to give her the medications that could have treated this infection. Begging, not for 7 minutes, not for 8 minutes, not for that, for months. I can guarantee you, from September 20th until she died, We were at that hospital every day, pleading, begging, run the test. We know she has this infection. Treat her. Treat her. Please treat her. My children were there. My husband was there. Her family flew in to see her. We were begging them. Begging them. They moved her down the hall closer and they still wouldn't treat her. Please come round on her. Come round on her. Please treat her. And so, and I'm telling you, we, all of us, we're crying, we're begging, we're pleading with them. The nurses were crying. The nurses were asking for them, those doctors to round. And I'm telling you, it wasn't 8 minutes. It was months. And we tried to meet with them. After my daughter died, we tried to meet with them. We did everything we could to avoid this litigation because I didn't want to be here. I don't blame everybody at the hospital, but I want to know who did it. I want to know who did it. And they won't even give us the records that we were entitled to have with the records request. All right. And the only reason we're here, and then they said they're going to have to sue me for slander. Well, maybe that's the only way I get the records, is they sue me. Okay, then, if that's what it takes.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms.
Smith. Sorry. I'm so sorry.
No, that's not.
Can I make a suggestion about narrowly tailoring? One last thing that I wanted to summarize with.
Briefly.
Because that's what I wanted to say, is I believe that it's very critical that a way to tailor this very broad statute is to limit to, you have to be physically present. Because I've literally watched television shows talk about people being harmed by watching on social media, and that's not addressed. And I think that it's very possible that you could have hundreds of thousands of people assert physical PTSD trauma from watching something on social media. And I think
so you would limit the application of the statute to those shows, in this case, personally observed, and your allegation is that the family members personally observed this in the hospital.
Yeah, you would have to be in the physical presence. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Smith. Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Thank you, Mr. Whitmore. Thank you, Ms. Nierengarten. We will carefully consider all the issues that have been raised by both the parties and the judges in their questioning. That being our second and last oral argument today, we are now adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.